You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 24th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone doing?
I'm good. Steve, it's a good question.
Yeah.
I've realized now that I don't really know how well I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out, like, overall, what, in 2020, like, I don't know, should I talk to you about how I'm feeling today?
Well, are you 98.6? What are you?
Yeah, like,
too vague a question?
It is a big question because it's everything is so weird, you know?
It is, yeah.
It's not natural.
Yeah. But could be better.
We're adapting. Let's go over the COVID numbers. The interesting thing, because if you look at the curve for the world, we're still on the upswing.
Yeah.
This pandemic is accelerating still.
Yep.
We haven't even crested the first wave. Mm. You know, if you're looking at new daily cases worldwide, that slope is still increasingly going up. If we're talking about daily new cases, the greatest single number of new cases was on June 19th, 182,182 cases on June 19th. So, you know, that we have to keep that in mind. I think if you're in a part of the world that's past the crest of the wave, it feels like it's over, but it really isn't. And the United States is a microcosm of that, right? Because the wave is going through the United States and the Northeast, where four of the five of us live, we're past the peak and we're on the downslope. But other than the Northeast, the rest of the country and most states are still increasing. They're still pre-crest, you know, of that first wave.
We had like a weird thing where we were extended in California and now it's like getting worse again. Like we thought we were on the other side of it, but then when we opened, of course.
Well, that's the other thing.
Nuts. Yeah.
The opening, so it's kind of a bi-humped wave because we did sort of manage to flatten it, but now it's turning. But we didn't really turn it down, but it did sort of start in those. In some states, it was flattening and then they opened up cautiously, and that's good. And then some states opened up not so cautiously, and there. Surging. They are spiking. Yeah. Like Arizona is the worst right now, but Florida, also really, really bad.
Mm.
A bunch of other states are really spiking, you know. So we're not out of the woods yet. You know, this is the I don't know if this is the home stretch, but this is that part of the marathon where like you really got to dig down and keep going.
And that's challenging because it's summer and everyone wants to be outside. We all want to be at the beach. Yeah. We all want to be at parties and social gatherings. It's a normal time of year otherwise to do those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But we still have to be cautious and take all the precautions necessary.
Mm. So total cases worldwide, 9.5 million. Total deaths, 483,000. So approaching 500,000. In the U.S., we're approaching 120,000 deaths.
What are the projections, Steve?
So it's really hard. So we're at least 119,000, they're saying, in the U.S. alone. 2.3 million cases. This is almost certainly an underestimate. The states that are spiking the most are Arizona, South Carolina, Florida, Texas, Oklahoma, and Idaho. You know, I've read one analysis that says that this first wave is probably going to end with about 200,000. That's about where we're going to land. And then second wave is anyone's guess, right? It depends on what happens at that point. But given that we're at 119 now and most states are still on the increase, that seems like a reasonable estimate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot there, but then the farther out you go, obviously the more variables there are. So it becomes harder to predict. And like there's still like the big unknown of when a vaccine is going to become available. And we, you know, hear conflicting things. So I think the experts are just making their best guess based upon where we are right now, but nobody could really say for sure. But that could be a game changer. We'll see. This is, again, a lot of variables there.
And don't forget, some people estimate that our numbers now at 119,000 could be off by 30 to 50%. Could be low by 30 to 50%.
Really?
Yeah. It could be that significantly off.
One specific thing. I wrote my science-based medicine blog this morning on this mass event held in a Phoenix megachurch. Have you guys heard about this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was actually interviewed for Inside Edition, which I think aired last night, and but I wrote about it today as well. And they're holding a Trump rally there. Actually, they did yesterday, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the owners of the church said, we're good, we're okay, because we've installed this special air ventilation, air filtration system that will remove 99.9% of the COVID virus within 10 minutes. So everyone is safe. Everyone
is safe. Then
why don't we have that
flim-flam
on every plane if that really works? Yeah.
The church is a massive complex, but it has a main auditorium that can hold several thousand people at one time. So it's big. It's like this big, kind of somewhat circular auditorium. So, I wrote an article basically breaking down why that claim that is total nonsense. The idea that if you have an effective air filtration system that you can mass gather inside.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple quick points. I'll just hit the highlights. The idea that it removes 99.9% of the virus, that in isolation is plausible because HEPA filters can do that. The question is, how much time would it take to do that? Now, they said 10 minutes, but that's based upon a study of a small, closed, sealed-off room.
Right. And also, that's all just what's aerosolized, right? Like, or not aerosolized, but like, I don't know what the right word is, but physically hanging in the air. Anything that like falls out of your mouth when you're talking and then settles wouldn't be picked up by the HEPA filter.
Exactly. Right. So that you're getting a couple steps ahead. But yeah, so the, you're right. So that's why even if it did work, it won't work. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For now, we're just talking about, does it even do that? Does it even remove? So, HEPA filters can remove viruses. They can remove droplets of water that contain viruses, even the small, fine aerosolized droplets. But it's all about like how long would it take to basically refresh the air in a room. So that the 10 minutes thing is that's what's utter nonsense. That's based upon a small sealed room. Does not apply to a massive auditorium. Air purifiers are rated by their CFM, which is their cubic feet per minute. But more importantly, if you multiply basically the efficiency times the cubic feet per minute of air moving through, you get the CADR, which stands for the clean air delivery rate. And that's usually the number is in cubic feet, right? So if you have a CADR of 400, that means that essentially that system would replace 400 cubic feet of air with fresh air every minute. So an auditorium like that could easily be hundreds of thousands of cubic feet though, right? Oh, wow. So you need a system with a CADR in the thousands, the tens of thousands. That's a massive system. And then even then, it might take an hour or more to like fully cycle through all the air, not 10 minutes. But the limiting factor on air filtration systems is noise, right? You could replace all the air in that auditorium every 10 minutes if you had an air tunnel in there. You know what I mean?
like a jet engine hooked up to the darn thing.
But if you're going to keep background noise, I mean, the bigger units are actually quieter. Like the really small fans going very fast with the same volume would be louder than a big fan going slower. But you need big fans moving a lot of air in order to get any kind of meaningful air purification going on. You've been in buildings where like there's a massive air purification system and you could hear this background roar from the air handlers, but imagine that times 10 or whatever. But
it's like the smoking rooms at like airports and stuff like that. They have this like crazy thing where they suck all the air up first and then filter it because it's so like there's so much cigarette smoke in the air.
Like hell.
And it still stinks.
So the claim that it could meaningfully replace the air on any kind of time frame that would have an effect is ridiculous. But even, if it did remove a lot of the virus through the system itself, that's not how the virus spreads, right? Most of the spread's not going to be from picking up an aerosolized droplet that's floating around in the air when you have a bunch of people packed tightly together. You're going to be directly spraying it onto other people and onto things and onto stuff and touching your face and whatever. And so no air purification system is going to get between you and the person next to you, right? That's the bottom line. So there's no real reason to think that the people in that auditorium were any safer because of the existence of this air purification system, even if we take the claims of efficiency and whatever at face value, which probably is not a good idea. But even if we do, it's meaningless.
Then why did they say that? You know, I don't understand why they would even go there. It seems like they're opening themselves up to a lawsuit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they apparently believe it. Who knows? You know, or they just were saying it to justify what they were doing. But so in reading about this, a lot of sites say, so we don't really know if it works with COVID-19. It does work with other, the HEPA filters work with other coronaviruses. So, all right, let's assume that it does work. The way that it might be helpful is let's say you have somebody who has COVID-19 and they're convalescing at home. You can put this in the room that they're in, right? You can have a really good air filtration system. And they basically say, though, this is, again, we'll put things into context. You should have enough in the room so that it's as much as possible without it being so loud they can't sleep.
Right.
Right.
Their quality of life is important.
Yeah. So you're pushing it basically to the limits of tolerability of noise in order to have a reasonable chance that it's going to reduce the risk of the rest of the family getting exposed because of distant aerosolized spread. But that's nothing to do with close-up direct contact spread. You still need to social distance and wear masks and not touch anything, et cetera, et cetera. So probably the only effect, I would guess, of this claim, of claiming that the air was being purified, was to give the people present a false sense of security and weaken their other measures that probably would be effective, or at least would reduce the spread a little bit. So it probably, if anything, just made it worse. And by all accounts, it was a packed hall.
Right, yeah.
And honestly, people were seriously waiting for, the 1 to 2 weeks to see the spikes that are almost guaranteed to result from these mass rallies that are starting up now with the presidential season. Trump's had two so far, one in Oklahoma, which is spiking, one in Arizona, which is the state that is most spiking. That was probably the reddest red zone in the country, where they had that most recent rally. So, and of course, a lot of people are also talking about the Black Lives Matter protests. A couple of big differences there. One, most of those are outside. And, being outside is the best air purification system that there is.
Sure. Sure. You can't beat that.
And a lot of people are wearing masks. And but yes, with those caveats aside, it is more, there's less social distancing. It's, people in the same space. So there may be a bump from those as well. But hopefully, it'll be minimal because it's, it's outside and people are trying to be responsible while still exercising their free speech rights, very importantly.
Our state today just passed a executive order in which now, if you're coming in from any of these states, like you mentioned, Steve, 14 days quarantine, you must quarantine for 14 days.
New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey.
It might be like when you're going to the UK, which is, the EU has different rulings. And I think some of those borders are actually going to be closed soon. We've been reading about that. But in the UK, the quarantine, from what I've gathered right now, is that when you enter the country, when you go through customs, you have to show an address, you're going to a home. You have to prove to them that you have a place you're going. And so I think the idea is just that, you're basically going to be in lockdown. I don't think it matters where you quarantine.
Okay.
You could be staying with a family member. You could be staying at, your second home if you have one. I don't think hotels are open in a lot of places. So you probably can't quarantine in a hotel. But so long as you can show, this is a residence that I'm going to. And then I think the idea is you can't leave for 2 weeks.
Wow.
You really need to do what we did early on and maintain full lockdown for 2 weeks.
Jeez, I wonder how many people are going to abide by that.
I know. It's so not enforceable, It's how are they going to know?
That's very challenging. I just find the whole thing so unpoliceable. And so, what? So much is going on people's word.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not ending anytime soon. I think that's the one thing that we can say. This is not over yet. Not by a long shot. And the officials are starting to say that frequently. Fauci is saying that, he's in the U.S., the main epidemiologist, in the administration, handling the pandemic. And he's this pandemic is going to take a long time. This is not going to be over anytime soon. Okay, let's move on with the news items. But Jay, you're going to start us off with a COVID-19 related news item. There's just so much, it's hard to avoid it, about electrified masks. We're going to electrify the masks that we're wearing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you guys, of course, have heard of PPE or the personal protective equipment. I remember, Carrie, you were the first person I heard say PPE, and I was like, what is that? I didn't even know what it was. I felt like everybody knew that, and I didn't know, and I felt stupid. So I looked it up secretly.
And now it's like in all of our kind of dictionaries, isn't it?
Yeah. So when we talk about this, we're usually talking about like a wearable mask, the kind that most of us have. You know, in the regions where the virus is still happening, it's still a threat. Most people have one, right? You know, most people have acquired a mask. They're wearing it. They probably keep it in their car or whatever, in their purse. And we have to be smart about this because we should be wearing these even if we're visiting family. You know, it's a good idea. We have in my family, you have been doing like Steve works at the hospital. So we do the 20-foot rule. It's very hard to do it. And everybody has to remind everybody else to do it, but we got to do it. So for some of us, this has become routine and the risk is, you know, I don't want to say it's low, but it's relatively low, right? If you follow the correct protocols, you can be in a safe range where it's okay to visit. Even wearing a mask, though, it's not foolproof. And especially for healthcare workers that are in environments like Steve, where you're in a hospital, you know, some people are working directly with people who have COVID-19. You know, if you touch the fabric on the mask that's contaminated, and you don't know if it's contaminated, you're just, you know, figuring I got to treat it like it is contaminated, you can easily pass the virus to yourself or to others. You know, just removing the mask, you're putting your hand on your face. You know, are you wearing a glove? Are you not? How carefully are you removing your gloves and your clothing? You know, your clothing could have the virus on it as well. You know, even though it's probably not as much as a mask would, but still, you know, if you're in an environment all day as a medical worker, yeah, your clothing is infected. You gotta wash it. So researchers have been trying to come up with a solution for this. Chandran Sen, who is the director of the Indiana Center for Regenerative Medicine and Engineering at Indiana University, and the research team there have been working on a way to kill pathogens that touch the fabric on a mask. And Steve said it. They have been working on electroceutical, right? You ever hear that? Electroceutical, C-E-U-T-I-C-A-L.
Right, like pharmaceutical.
Yeah, like pharmaceutical.
Yeah.
So they have they're calling it an electroceutical material, and the idea is to generate an electric field that would go across the surface of a piece of fabric, and that electric field could kill pathogens that come in contact with it. So they take a polyester material and then they print areas of silver and zinc on top of it, kind of in like a polka dot pattern. And these areas are only about 2 millimeters wide and spaced about a millimeter apart. And once the fabric is dampened with saliva or vapor that comes from exhaling or anything, any way that the fabric can get moistened, there are ions in the liquid that will trigger an electrochemical reaction. And the silver and zinc,
the papers.
Right? You have the papers? The silver and zinc can then generate a very weak electric field, and this can disrupt the pathogens, which is cool. This is such a, you know, a really cool idea. You're not plugging it in. It's not battery operated. It's just going off of the silver and zinc that are present. So far, the fabric has been tested on different coronavirus strains, not COVID-19, but a different strain, and another pathogen that is called lentivirus. I read that at first. When I first read it, I thought it said lentil virus, and I got very excited. So the fabric was able to render both of these viruses unable to infect cells. The researchers are going to submit the results that they have from their research into a peer-reviewed journal, and hopefully in the near future, the fabric can be a big help. So like I said, they have not tested COVID-19 yet. I don't know why, but they're starting on other viruses to find out like its effect on them, and then they'll move to COVID-19. And if everything goes well, they said that the good news is that this is not a hard thing to manufacture. There's already manufacturing facilities and companies out there that can produce this. You know, the technology is totally there, and it would not be that expensive, which, you know, how often do you hear, hey, came up with a really cool idea, we can manufacture it already if it works, you know, once the testing and everything has been approved, and it's not going to be that expensive. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody is saying that this is a slam dunk. Of course, they need the peer review process to make sure that everything that they're doing is as they say and as their initial research. But the idea here, the physics behind this is all sound.
Yeah, I'm not worried about the physics. The question is, you know, even if the mask performs as advertised, will it actually reduce the spread of the virus in the real world? Right.
Mm-hmm. And then
we don't know, you know, that you have to do some kind of real world test to see if it reduces actual spread. So the question is, you know, are people getting the virus, getting infected by virus that at some point in time was on the surface of a mask that would, you know, potentially be inactivated by this technology? It's not implausible. It's just one of those questions that we can't really answer without directly testing it.
And really, ultimately, like, why, right? I mean, my question is maybe less so for community spread, but for, like, within a medical facility. And I'm also likening this unto, like, when I used to work in a lab, I kept a clean room because we worked with brain cells and we didn't culture them in antibiotics. So we had to keep a clean room to keep our cells, you know, going hard. So we were completely scrubbed in, completely sterile. And there are certain things that we would autoclave, which is this basically pressure cooker, like really high temperature, under pressure, and you would clean like metal tools and glassware in the autoclave, and that
you
would
put it in the autoclave and
yes.
And that would allow you to fully sterilize non-single use things. But masks, gloves, shoe covers, hair nets, all of those things we would just use single use and throw away. And yes, it's more wasteful, but it's also more sterile. Like, there's a reason that we use these things single use is because we know it works. We know that when you first take it out of the sterilized package, it's going to be perfectly clean. And when you're walking out of the room at the end, you can throw it in the trash bin. And it's like soup to nuts. You know that your system works. And it seems like, why fix something that's not broken? I remember early on, we didn't have enough PPE, but I think most hospitals have enough now. So isn't single use still the gold standard?
So, oh yeah, absolutely. Single use is certainly the most sterile. But I guess the question is, like, even if, like, if I use one mask for the whole day, you know, would this be advantageous to reducing the viral load on my mask for that day? But the other question is, would these masks be cheap enough to be disposable? And if not, are they washable? You know, or is that going to short circuit them or something?
And is also washable good enough?
Yeah.
You know, because then it's like, now it's going to a facility, or it's going, you know, it's like just another way to spread potential infection. I don't know. It seems kind of like trying to solve a problem that's not, that doesn't exist, sort of, to me, but I could be wrong.
So, I mean, it's an interesting, you know, idea, and it would be an interesting proof of concept, you know, if you have fabric that can use this type of technology to kill bacteria and viruses, and maybe it will find a niche somewhere. Mm. Or should I say a niche somewhere. But
I say niche.
I know, I just grew up saying it that way.
Niche.
But yeah, that's why you need to study. This is definitely one of those things where you need to study real world use in order to know what the net effect is, because you could sort of make an argument for or against it based on just first principles. You know, we need research to sort it out. But interesting. We'll see if it goes anywhere. It wouldn't really surprise me either way. But I just hope it's not one of those things that people use just because it appears to be high tech. You know what I mean? There's that.
Right.
There definitely is a high tech bias where.
Yeah, where it's like, yeah, the old school paper in the little, you know, plastic packaging that you throw away. It doesn't feel high tech at all, but it's like it works and it's clean.
Sometimes low tech is better.
And also, low tech usually costs a lot less, so you can implement it better.
Right.
Interesting.
All right, Bob, have you heard of the mask gap problem?
Yeah. Yeah.
In astronomy, anyone else?
Nope.
The mass gap.
Mass gap. I think we've touched on it before.
Black hole, we have.
There's missing mass.
Then I mean, yes.
To explain everything in the class.
Nope.
Black hole, neutron star, right?
Nope. It has nothing to do with missing mass. The mass gap has to do with, what Bob said. It has to do with the gap between neutron stars and black holes. So, quick recap. When the stars go supernova, they leave behind a remnant. And if that remnant is big enough, it will collapse. Well, at the low end, it's like a white dwarf. The white dwarf gets big enough, it collapses all the way down into a neutron star. And then if the neutron star gets big enough, it collapses all the way down to a black hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the question is, that's a very simple summary of that. But the idea is the bigger the remnant left behind, you know, the more gravity it has. And there are these milestones, you know, one where it collapses into, it overcomes the repulsion.
Electron degeneracy, neutron degeneracy.
Yeah, exactly. It overcomes the repulsion between protons and electrons, and then you get basically one giant neutron. And then, but that's held up by degeneracy pressure. And then once the mass overcomes that, it collapses all the way down to a singularity and you have a black hole. So but the question is, where's that dividing line between a neutron star and a black hole? What is the precise mass at which a neutron star will then collapse down to become a black hole? So, and how would we know? Well, we could try to figure it out theoretically, but we don't really have the physics to do that because we don't know how the laws of physics behave under those extreme conditions. You know, we need a theory of quantum gravity or something, you know, to tell us how the quantum forces and relativistic forces interact when both are in play in these types of situations. So
well said.
We're at the limits of our theoretical physics here. So it would be nice if we could observe where that dividing line is, and that may help inform our theoretical physics. But that's where the mass gap comes in. And that's there's the problem here. So we've observed neutron stars up to a certain size and black holes down to a certain size. And there's a gap between those two. So the smallest black holes we've found are about 5 solar masses. The biggest neutron stars are like around the 2.2, 2.3 solar masses. So basically between like 2.5 to 3 to 5 solar masses, there's a gap, like where we don't find anything. We don't find any neutron stars or black holes.
Steve, I thought we found a 3.1 solar mass neutron star.
All right, you're getting ahead of the story.
Okay, so, never mind.
So astronomers are looking for objects in this gap because that will tell us about, you know, where that demarcation line is between neutron stars and black holes. And also, you know, we want to know, why are we finding so few things? Even if there's one, or we end up finding one or two in there, why so few? Why aren't they just scattered, evenly distributed across the mass, you know, continuum? Why do they clump on one side or the other of this apparent gap? We don't know.
A prevailing theory of some sort.
We don't know. We don't have the physics for it to really know. And it just may be that how black holes form, they tend to be bigger. You know what I mean? Things that make black holes. So, but Bob alluded to the fact that we have in recent years been finding things that may be falling in this gap. There, just a couple years ago, there was the September object, an object that was found where they thought it was 2.8 solar masses. But it turns out that that one didn't pan out, that the probability of it being an actual mass gap object, as they call them, was less than 1%. So this is the news item, is that astronomers now claim that they have found another potential mass gap object, this one towards the neutron star end of the spectrum. They think it has 2.6 solar masses, which means it would be the largest neutron star or the smallest black hole we've yet detected, one of those two. But again, in knowing which one it is, or maybe there's a third class of object that's in that mass gap, and we don't know what that is, and we're not finding them because we're not looking for them or whatever. Mm. So how do you think, I don't know, Bob, if you've read this story, but how do you think we discovered this 2.6 solar mass gap?
Well, probably with gravitational lensing?
Nope. Not a bad guess. But there's a great guess.
What are you talking about? then not micro lensing, right?
Not micro lensing. Okay. So Bob, your favorite new branch of astronomy, gravitational waves.
Of course.
So yeah. They detected what they think is a neutron star colliding with a black hole, or they detected two objects colliding with each other, right? One of those two objects is 2.6 solar masses, and the other one is 23 solar masses. So the 23 solar masses is clearly a black hole. The 2.6 is in the mass gap. So what is it? We don't know. The headline says it's a black neutron star, which is basically saying it's in the middle.
I like that.
And we don't know.
It's transitioning.
I feel like when Kirk called the black hole a black star.
A black star.
Did he?
So, yeah. Remember, very quick review on gravitational astronomy. You have two lasers at right angles with each other, and they cause interference where they overlap. And a ripple in time space caused by a massive gravitational event, like a black hole colliding with a neutron star, or two black holes colliding, or two neutron stars colliding, things like that. Those ripples in space-time are very tiny, teeny tiny, but they can be felt by these gravitational wave detectors because of the laser interferometry is so sensitive down to like the subatomic scale.
Whoa.
Right. So those 90-degree laser beams, one of them is distorted, right? Depending on what angle the gravitational wave, and that distortion causes the light then to be out of phase, right? And then causing interference, and then say, oh, we got something.
Jay, this is like when Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader crossed lightsabers, and at that point, they detected gravitational waves. Right, Jay?
This is actually what happens when you cross the streams with your proton accelerators.
Oh, Ghostbusters, of course.
So, anyway.
Insert Kara laughter here.
Come on, that was Ghostbusters. All right. So this may seem very rarefied, all this stuff we're talking about, but it's important because we do have this new window onto the universe. If two massive things collide anywhere in the universe, pretty much, as long as they're within our relativity envelope, we'll be able to detect it with these super sensitive detectors. And we're seeing stuff that we haven't seen before. And, this mass gap problem is very interesting because in that gap, there is new physics. And that's always a good place to look, right? We want new physics.
Yes, we
want to know
what's
happening in there. Why is there this gap? And, so it's, mysteries are what get scientists out of bed in the morning because that's how we're going to solve them, by looking for stuff that doesn't make any sense that we can't readily explain. So this is cool. So this is something that we're probably going to be coming back to again in the future. Now you know what the mass gap problem is between neutron stars and black holes. And when we discover a new mass gap object, you'll understand why it's so exciting and so interesting as we start to flesh out this part of the universe, what is going on there. The other question, by the way, is more of an astronomical question than a physics question. And that is, well, what's happening to create these mass gap objects? Because, there's only certain ways you get to a black hole. And so what is happening? So there's one astronomer, has a theory that if you have like a three-star, a triple star system, he came up with some kind of way in which that could result in a mass gap, mass black hole. He's kind of on the fringe because it's just like one guy's theory. But as we start to find objects in this gap, they're starting to pay more attention to theories like that about, astronomically what could happen so that you get to that amount of mass left over that, leading to a mass gap object. So there's going to be new astronomy here as well. And again, this may be a new kind of astronomical object. It may be a black neutron star, whatever that is.
Yeah, that'd be cool. So what really sucks about this is that, no matter what tools we develop in the future, it won't matter because this 2.6 solar mass object has been absorbed into a black hole. So it's like,
well, it's gone. I know.
It's gone. It's done.
Yeah. We detected,
we lost the moment.
We detected its destruction, and that's it. That's all we will ever know about it is that it had 2.6 solar masses before it was, as you say, sucked into the 23.
This turned into a tragedy.
But, we're detecting them at a steady rate. The good thing about this is that the good thing about the gravitational wave detectors, is that they look in every direction at the same time, right?
Yeah,
is that they could detect these mass collisions anywhere in the universe. We don't have to be looking in the right direction. So that's, we're going to start detecting these. We are detecting these now on a regular basis. We're just getting started. So we'll hear about more mass gap objects in the not too distant future. All right, Kara, what is vaccine nationalism?
I want to ask you guys, because I know, Steve, that you look at some of the stories before we sit down to record, but I'm wondering, Jay, Bob, and Evan, have you guys heard this term before, vaccine nationalism?
I have not.
No,
I never even heard of it.
Right. So there's a great piece in The Conversation about it that also references a former WHO board member from Australia who has warned against this kind of trend of vaccine nationalism, especially in places like the U.S., Russia, and India. And it really is kind of, I guess, what you would assume when you think about those words, this intention or this want, or in some cases, an actual policy to ensure that a certain amount of a new vaccine is held aside or prioritized or pre-purchased for your own country. This piece in The Conversation, which is written by an expert in medical law, really kind of breaks down why vaccine nationalism is contrary to public health, and it could potentially be really dangerous globally. One of the things that she talks about quite a bit is the idea of pre-purchase agreements. And so it's well documented at this point that the American government reached out to a pharmaceutical company in Germany to try to enter into a pre-purchase agreement with a COVID vaccine that's in development right now. So basically it's, I want to have the right to do a pre-order and get like the first batches and have like a specific number of vaccines that come to us first. And we're going to pay for that, right? And famously, Angela Merkel said, yeah, that's not going to happen. If we develop something in Germany, it's going to be for Germany and for the whole world. Germany's not for sale. That was her quote. But then we did reach out to Sanofi, which was a French pharmaceutical company, and tried to do the same thing. They actually agreed, but then there was public outcry, and so they started to change their stance a little bit. And there is also evidence to show that this is happening in both India and in Russia. That kind of culminates in an important takeaway, which is that India, Russia, and the U.S. all elected not to become part of or participate in the Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator launched by the WHO. And that was, you know, an accelerator to try and promote collaboration across countries, because this is, of course, a global problem. And I think that there's not just two, many ways to look at it, but if you were to pick kind of a vague division, you might have the people who argue this needs to be a collaborative effort, and then you might have the people that say this needs to be a capitalist competitive effort. You know, which one is going to give us the better outcome? Public health officials are saying this needs to be collaborative and that we need to be really, really careful about vaccine nationalism, because it actually results in something that, from an economic perspective, is called a deadweight loss problem. Deadweight loss is basically what happens when the two main factors that, I don't know, perpetuate an economy, or at least a capitalist kind of purchasing power, is supply and demand. And deadweight loss happens when those two forces go out of whack. Like, there's too much demand, there's not enough supply. And ultimately, when you're talking about things that can affect health and human life, you end up with an outcome that is actually potentially negative for like actual social welfare. And that's the real concern here. So these resources not being able to be allocated efficiently could actually lead to a reduction of welfare for everybody. And one of the things that's interesting is that in the article and in some other articles that I've seen, they talk a lot about how, you know, if one nation, and oftentimes it's a wealthier nation, is in a position to pre-purchase, what ends up happening is that poorer or more developing nations are hit the hardest. And of course, this leads to negative outcomes for everyone. But the argument isn't as well made, I think. It seems to be made from a very altruistic perspective, which of course, I think from a humanistic perspective is an important argument to make. And I was trying to play a little bit of devil's advocate and say, okay, but what about people who are like not actually interested in ethics? And like, they just want to say, I want mine first. I deserve it because I have the money. Ultimately, what are the negative consequences of that? Not just that obviously impoverished nations or places where people are struggling the most are hit the hardest, but in a global pandemic, everybody's affected. Like, that's the important thing to remember, right? We don't have borders per se. They're quite wiggly. People can fly, people can walk, people can drive right across these things, and diseases spread. It's very hard to localize them, especially something like COVID-19, as we've all seen evidence of. But two, one thing that's not mentioned in the article, but I could see before my very eyes, is that this kind of strategy can backfire fantastically. And we saw that here in the US when, not in terms of vaccine nationalism, but in terms of COVID testing nationalism, the same thing happened. We said, we want a test and it needs to be an American test, right? So first we went to Germany and said, we want to buy your testing capability, but we can only use it in America. Germany said, F no, we're not doing that. And so we said, fine, we're not going to go onto the global marketplace. We're going to develop our own because, you know, and there were arguments for it. We can trust it more. We have our own checks and balances. We have our own regulatory processes. But what ended up happening, one of the reagents in the test was contaminated. And so now we were set back weeks and weeks and weeks with testing capacity. And we've seen that this has had a tragic effect on the way that we've managed this massive health crisis here within the U.S. And of course, you can read about those. You can read about that aspect separately. There's a lot of great articles that dig into the nuance of it. So the idea here is, where vaccine nationalism on its surface might seem like, if you're lucky enough and privileged enough to be in the group who gets the vaccine first, you're going to be A-okay. It's actually got this paradoxically super negative effect, even if you are one of those people, you know, and I like to think of it as like triage. So when you look at this WHO group, this accelerator, one of the things that the author of this article at least recommends is having a system in place in the future, because we know that a pandemic like this is not going to just go away. And it's not like this is the last one we're going to see. We're going to see pandemics. There's a reason we need preparedness for this kind of thing. There's a reason we need policy at the top levels of governments, nationwide, but also a global kind of consortium. And one of the things that this author recommends is to have, I guess, kind of a strategy in place before things get really bad for how do we triage, you know, who is the most vulnerable in terms of nations? Within those nations, who should get a vaccine first? Healthcare workers, immunocompromised individually, people who are at the most risk, right? But the problem when you look at this as a purely kind of capitalist or even as a nationalist issue is that a lot of those considerations go out the window. And it's basically the people with the most means get access first.
Kara, do these companies need the money, upfront money, in order to produce the vaccines?
So they sometimes do. And I think that that's an important point, Evan, that you say. So this idea of pre-purchase agreements is very different from the kind of larger idea of vaccine nationalism. Pre-purchase agreements can really work, right? Pre-purchase agreements can be really, really helpful. And they happen quite a lot. There's a couple examples in here of pre-purchase agreements for incentivization to manufacture vaccines that, like, for example, you wouldn't really make a lot of money on. So there's an institution like, I think Gavi is how you pronounce it, which is a nonprofit based in Geneva, and they guarantee vaccines for developing countries. Of course, if this were just a regular market pressure situation, they wouldn't have enough money to do the R&D on the vaccine. So pre-purchase agreements can help facilitate that. But it's actually rare when we're talking about a pandemic versus, let's say, an epidemic, right? Something that strikes everybody, it strikes hard, it's global, and really the entire world needs to be working together to contain it, because any one nation not pulling their weight or any one nation being left behind can actually down the road lead to like devastation globally. And so this researcher who wrote the article specifically said, I see vaccine nationalism as a misuse of pre-purchase agreements. And she actually mentions that there's a backfire effect that can happen, because if you look at sort of the way that we price drugs globally, the US is really well known for having very high drug prices. And part of that is because we fund a lot of the research, right? So there is a downstream explanation. But even beyond that explanation, a lot of critics argue that basically because of managed care in America, because of the way that the insurance companies work, we can get away with charging a whole lot more for drugs than other countries sell the exact same drugs for. And so what happens, this is where the deadweight loss really comes in. what happens when we have exclusive rights for a vaccine and it incentivizes the drug company that's developing it to price it for a U.S. market. Well, not only does it price out a lot of people who are underinsured or in not in a position to be able to pay for the vaccine out of pocket, but it might potentially price out the rest of the world if that vaccine becomes the gold standard. So it really does have a negative economic effect and a negative public health effect, and it's something to be really careful about.
Yeah, I mean, we have to take these kind of things into consideration because, as we're seeing, I think it's one thing that I hope will come out of this pandemic, and that is that certain health issues are global. You know, it is we're one species. You know, a virus doesn't know national boundaries or anything. Yeah, we do have to kind of you have to think globally. I know it's a cliche, but I don't, what's more true about that than things that we share, like the environment and infectious disease? You know.
And one thing that I think really bears mentioning here is that, as is pointed out again by the author of this article, Anna Santos Rushman, who's at St. Louis University, she makes the point that this is not like a hypothetical concern of this kind of backfire, dead weight loss effect, because it's already been established that the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, has already told Congress that the government is not going to set standards. The government's not going to intervene to ensure the affordability of the COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. Because they've really been promoting that private industry does the development and the manufacturing. And they're concerned that if the U.S. sets prices, that the vaccine won't be profitable. But you know what? I mean, this is where this conversation really comes in about healthcare in general. And you can, you know, think what you want to think. But maybe in the most extreme examples, like a global pandemic, profitability shouldn't be the first consideration.
Yeah, as I said, whatever works the best. You know, we are in the middle of a pandemic. You know, stemming the pandemic itself has to take first priority. All right, thanks, Kara. Evan, you're going to finish up with us with a COVID-19 news item as well. Tell us about this. So some tennis star came down with COVID-19. Tell us about this guy.
Oh, boy, Steve, not just some tennis star. Novak Djokovic. He is the best men's division tennis player on the planet. And he has
no joke.
Yeah, no joke. That is one of his nicknames, the Joker joke. He has COVID-19. Now, this in of itself might not be all that alarming or newsworthy per se, because we've read about other athletes and celebrities and famous people having caught this nasty virus. But how he caught the virus, I think, is the actual news item of the day. And I believe to best understand the context of how he caught the virus is rather to ask, how did he put himself in a position to increase his chances of catching the virus? So that's what I want to unpack. And in order to do that, I have to give you a little bit of a background. Who is Novak Djokovic? Well, he is, and I do this for the benefit of the people who have been living in the proverbial cave the last 10 years, including Steve. Djokovic, as I said before.
I know who he is.
Okay, good. Well, you should.
It's for my benefit, Evan, let's be honest. I don't really understand that thing we call sports.
Sports. There's a sport called tennis. Hopefully I don't have to describe what tennis is. All right. Novak Djokovic. I mean, he's currently, and he has been for the much of the last decade, the top player in the men's division of professional tennis. Far and above everyone else. And his trophy shelf is as impressive as anyone's in the history of sports. Here's a quick rundown. Winner of 17 Grand Slam singles titles, which is the third most for a male player in history. And then you tack
Who's
on
the most?
Roger Federer with 20.
Yeah,
Roger Federer.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Rafael Nadal second with 19 and Novak Djokovic with 17. But you add to that, he's got 5 ATP Finals titles, 34 ATP Tour Master 1000 titles, 14 ATP Tour 500 titles, and he's held the number one spot in the rankings for the last 280 weeks, and again, most of this decade. In majors, he's won a record 8 Australian Open titles. Nobody's done that. He's got 5 Wimbledons, 3 US Opens, 1 French Open title. He's the 8th player to achieve the career Grand Slam, and he held all 4 major.
Whoa, nice.
And he held all 4 major titles at once, meaning he won them back to back to back to back over the course of 2 years, and the first person to do that since 1969. So
jeez, at what point do you retire? Are you like, yeah, I've done it. I could take a break.
He's 33 years old. So,
jeez,
yeah,
he's a baby.
I know.
Well, Kara, you got to look at it like this. These people have dedicated their entire life to the sport.
Oh yeah,
they must love it on some level, of course. And this is, you know, this is the payout, you know, like they're making money, they're enjoying it,
and he's still so young. Like, it sounds to me like he's got like a lot more left in him.
He is. Wow. He's still at the top of his game. And I think, you know, 33 in sports terms, that's really you're on the backside of your career. But we've seen athletes before who have, you know, gone on to do great things, remarkable things well into their 30s.
Well, and I think it also depends on the sport, too.
Sure. Sure.
Right. Like, I don't think tennis, like, it's brutal, yes, but I don't think it's like football. Football is notorious.
Yeah.
For just like destroying your body.
So, for the contact element
position
of it all, yes. Sure.
That's true.
Sure.
Yeah.
Punters are fine. They're fine.
Most of the time they are.
We got older punters.
But as far as Djokovic goes, suffice to say, this is a very impressive resume, and he's unquestionably one of the best players who has ever played. But
I still like Bjorn Borg.
me too, Steve. Right there with you.
Yep, absolutely. Oh gosh, remember that in the '70s, Jimmy Connors, and the John McEnroe.
As much for temperament as you know how good a player he was.
Oh, the John McEnroe matches were just all time tennis great moments. But in any case, I diverge. But hey, do you know what Mark Twain once said? He said, "With great power comes great responsibility."
I thought that was Stanley.
Oh, wait, you're right. I think so. But everything gets attributed to Mark
Twain. Mark Twain said everything.
Mark Twain said everything because the internet said so. The point is, when you are effectively, say, you know, the Michael Jordan of your sport, the Serena Williams of your sport, Tom Brady, LeBron James, I mean, these are not just athletes. These are pinnacles of culture, which so many people, young, old, and otherwise, they pay great attention to what they say, what they do, what they eat, their action, their tweets, the interviews, everything. That's where Djokovic is. He's also arguably sports' number one embracer of pseudoscience. It's very sad. He has a history of using and actively promoting quackery that I think is unseen at this level. The very top athletes in their games promoting this kind of stuff. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. 2010, Djokovic sought the advice of Dr. Igor Satojevic, who is who's a nutritionist who holds a diploma from the Indian Institute of Magnetotherapy in Delhi and has studied traditional Chinese medicine. Mm. This doctor is the one who diagnosed Djokovic as suffering from celiac disease and instructed him to cut gluten out of his diet. And upon doing that, Novak went on and won 4 Grand Slams right after that, and he credited this doctor accordingly. But, you know, his relationship with the doctor actually ran much deeper. You see, this doctor, Dr. Satojevic, he is a quack. Well, maybe not. More of a guru, maybe, than an outright quack. But I want to read from you real quick a sample right from his homepage. This is the doctor's homepage. "The latest advances in science and mathematics are bringing us back to the holistic view. It has been proven mathematically that we exist in a minimum of 11 dimensions simultaneously and that all things are interconnected." Right, Bob? There's so much there is so much more to us than the sum of our physical parts. Again, this information is readily available if you know where to look, but it's not broadcast because there's too much invested in the current model, especially regarding the pharmaceutical industry. Western medicine has made great strides in treatment for war and accident victims, trauma, and so forth, but it's really not effective in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease and optimizing health. You know, once you realize that your own body has all the knowledge and full capacity to heal itself, you can take the reins and become responsible for your own health. There's no magic pill or insurance policy. You get the picture? You know, we've heard these things before, you know, stop with the toxins and you're feeding your body toxins. This is the doctor whom he credits with the strengthening and prolonging his tennis career for the last 10 years. All right, here's another quick example. Djokovic, part of his improvement over this past decade has been the use of a CVAC pod. CVAC, C-V-A-C, that stands for Cyclic Variations in Adaptive Conditioning, or a CVAC machine. The CVAC treatment involves placing someone inside a special chamber where air pressure will increase and decrease cyclically for about 20 minutes. According to the brochures, 3 20-minute sessions per week will eventually cause a series of positive changes in the person's body that include, but not limited to, stem cell replication, better sleep patterns, lactic acid removal, and stimulation of mitochondrial biogenesis. Now, the thing is, a lot of sites don't offer clear references and hard research of any kind on that this machine really does something positive to the human body. Regardless, he's employing this particular treatment and has been, you know, touting it and in some cases promoting it. And here's another example. Well, is it any surprise on this one? He's an anti-vaxxer.
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, no. Yep.
So, not surprised.
Just this past...
So he's going to be like a really awesome athlete until he gets a really horrible disease.
Well, that's where we're getting to. Well,
oh, we're, yeah, not, that's
we're
the
getting
whole
to that. Right, right. And this is what I'm building up to. This was just in past April. He was in a live Facebook conversation, live Facebook video. Here's what he said. Personally, I'm opposed to vaccination, and I wouldn't want to be forced by someone to take a vaccine in order to be able to travel. But if it becomes compulsory, what will happen? I have to make a decision. I have my own thoughts on the matter, and whether those thoughts will change at some point, I don't know. And his comments have fed into conspiracy theories about mandatory vaccinations. They've been circulating on Facebook. That includes one group called Collective Action Against Bill Gates. We won't be vaccinated. 160,000 members and counting. You know, the group promotes conspiracies about Bill Gates and so forth. And they use Djokovic's comments to justify their position. And this just happened in 2 months ago. And a few days later, after his live stream on Facebook, a video promoting conspiracy theories about 5G and coronavirus were shared by his wife, Jelena. It was labeled by Instagram as false information. That's the backdrop, okay? That's the context. So when I tell you that Djokovic and his team of professional handlers, and this is the news, organized a tennis tournament for charity and followed... basically, none of the basic protocols for COVID-19 control, such as mandatory masks and proper social distancing. And then you picture that against the background of his history and embracing the pseudoscience and his anti-vax opinions. Can anyone really be surprised that he caught COVID-19? But it's even worse than that, because several other players on the tour with him have come down with it. And who knows how many trainers, stadium workers, ticket holders have also come down with it. This tour was, it's called the Adria Tour. He was sponsoring it, he himself and his handlers, to be held in Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, Bosnia, and Herzegovina between June 12 and July 5th. It did get underway. It went to a couple of towns, and they have since canceled it after everybody has come down now with COVID.
Yeah.
You have to wonder how much of his so-called holistic health-related worldview has played a role in the fact that he contracted COVID-19 and made it part of his tennis tour and wound up spreading it.
Sure. I mean, it's funny how that one person, it's someone that comes in contact with a lot of people. They're moving around a lot because of the, you know, essentially the job that he has. And typically people that have some success are given gravitas. So it puts a lot of other people at risk, you know, from the ball boys to anybody that's going to be around him.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
Well, he's put himself into quarantine now, and he has issued an apology, you know, a little bit late, but, you know, at least an apology came from him saying this was, you know, obviously never his intention, not wanting to hurt anybody. They realized that once this had happened, they shut the tour down and realized that, you know, effectively admitting their mistake. Because guess what? All other tennis associations and tournaments and everything else, they're not having tournaments because they said, guess what? It's too soon to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But he went ahead anyways and did it and now is showing that, you know, all the other tennis minds and organizers were right and he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear the name Novak Djokovic, this is what you have to remember about him.
I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's no surprise, you know, that... athletes. I mean, first of all, athletes are athletes, right? There's no reason to expect, like, celebrities. Why would they have scientific knowledge? Right? It's not part of, you know, the profession. But also, sports athletes are notoriously superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you combine those two things. The thing is, there's, you know, placebo effects are really powerful in terms of the illusion that they create when you're engaged in that kind of, you know, cutting edge competitive endeavor. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've spoken about this on many sports-related pseudoscience topics.
Yeah.
That top athlete that needs that 0.001% edge over their competition in order to just, you know, ensure that they're going to, you know, give them every last little perceived advantage. And it's a lot of it is simply perceived advantage.
Well, yeah, that's right. And the other thing is that all athletes are doing this, right? And so if you focus only on the top athlete and say, what's he doing? It must be working.
Right.
No, what about all the crap that all the other athletes are doing? It's all the same stuff. You know, it's just there's a logical fallacy in there somewhere, right? It's like the Texas sharpshooter fallacy.
Right, yeah, where you paint the bullseye on after you shoot.
So it's something like that because you basically it's also cherry picking, right? You're just cherry picking examples that are picked ahead of time for having a positive outcome, right? Anyway, so, but it does create that, you know, it's great marketing though. You could sell all kinds of shit by just finding an athlete who will use it, convince themselves that it's helping. All the young kids who want to be like that athlete think, I got to be doing what they're doing. You know?
Yeah. And when they're spreading pseudoscience and anti-vax and other crap, very dangerous. Very dangerous. Yeah.
At least pseudoscience is a little bit less fashionable during a pandemic. There is that.
Yeah. Yeah. People under pressure.
It's less fashionable, but I'm amazed by how much there is out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not amazed. But yeah, it's still a lot out there, but you know. There's a little bit more bite to it when you say, hey, yeah, and this, you're helping to worsen the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Mark Lenahan wrote in and said, my guess for this week's noisy is a high-pressure jet of water cutting metal, possibly a large sheet or object.
Ooh, I love water jets.
Now, my first thing when I read this was that this might be to a different noisy, because I don't hear a high-pressure jet in this. Do you guys?
Well, but a water jet is like a tiny stream. It's like a little, it's you can really make fine cuts with it. And it's usually got, not usually, but sometimes has like a gemstone powder in it.
Yeah,
that improves its cutting capability. So it doesn't really sound like a water hose.
But would it sound like this noisy, though? I don't know. I
don't know. I was only half listening.
But I did get a few people that wrote that in. And, you know, there's a lot of times they don't identify what noisy. So I'm guessing like, well, it must be for this one. But I put that there because I did get a number of emails that were similar to that. Visto Tutti, you guys know who he is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We have not met him in person, but I suspect someday we will. He said, I hear insect wings beating the air, but there is a square wave harmonics to the sound. Nature would not be so wasteful of energy. So I'm saying that the sound is from artificial insect wings.
Artificial. Neat.
What?
Like a drone?
Yep.
Yeah, like a little ha, drone.
Yeah.
Like a drone.
That is also not correct, but interesting. And I love that he said that... he said nature would not be so wasteful of energy. That's pretty cool. Ashley Zink, Z-I-N-Y-K.
What are you thinking?
Zinnick?
Zink, right? Okay.
What are you thinking,
Zink,
Ashley?
Zinko. So Ashley Zink wrote, hi, Jay. I think the noisy in episode 780, and see how nice that is? Episode 780 was a very early audio recording, specifically one made in 1860 by Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville, a Parisian inventor. It's actually called a phonautograph that it was recorded on.
Mm-hmm.
These were not intended for playback, but viewed as squiggles on paper like a seismograph. You are correct, Ashley. And here is the actual, let me give you a little write-up here. Again, the original sound was sent in by a listener named Dan Whitaker. And Dan wrote, in this article, it's the earliest known recording of a human voice. The device used to record it was not intended for playback, but for visual analysis. Only in this century was the tech available to reproduce the visual traces from this device. So it is now believed that this week's Who's That Noisy is indeed the oldest reproducible recording of a human voice, even though it was not intended to be played back. Now, like I said, this is a phonoautograph. I believe it was invented in 1859. The barrel is made out of plaster of Paris, and the phonautograph is the earliest known device for recording sound of any kind. And previously, tracings had been obtained of the sound producing vibratory motions of tuning forks and other objects by physical contact with them, but not of actual sound waves as they propagated through air or other media. Very interesting. A recording of sound that was never intended to ever be heard has finally been heard.
Mm.
And boy, did the person that was singing sound like they were in pain or what? I don't know. But it does not sound fun.
But that's just because of the recording, yeah.
Probably. Or, you know, it could also mean that the person was not a good singer.
Was in pain?
You know? Yeah. It's good to sing. I have a new noisy for you guys this week, though. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Matt Rappaport. That's it.
That's it.
That sounds like a Rube Goldberg machine.
I would like you to explain to me what's happening, if you can. And at the very least, just tell me what the big picture idea is. You can email me your guess to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I will pull the line, good news, everyone, because we have some really, really good news.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I'm about to say because you're the one that made it happen. So we finally secured our keynote speaker for Nexus 2020, and it'll be Anne Drian.
Oh,
yes.
So exciting.
I'm melting.
That's
this is awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, when we first contacted her, when Steve first contacted her, her handler was very happy and excited about the whole thing. Everything was going good. And then things went quiet for a little while. Uh-huh. And we didn't know, you know, who knows? You know, the people are busy. They could have been traveling or whatever. So
she also just had the newest, you know, season of the show launch. So there's probably just a lot of work that around that. Yeah.
So Steve was persistent. And we did get a absolute confirmation. Now, we interviewed her not long ago. I'm very confident that she remembered who we were. I also remember talking to her after the interview, like saying, hey, if you're interested, we'd really love to have you speak at our conference. And she was all like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. But she meant it. So we're really excited. And I cannot wait to hear her give a talk. I also feel like the Q&A afterwards is going to be a lot of fun for the audience. So we have our final list of speakers. You can go to nexus.org, NECSS.org to see the final list. So listen, July 31st, Friday night, this will be Eastern Daylight Time at 8 p.m., we will be starting a two-hour-plus game show featuring three skeptical contestants. Steve, who are those three contestants?
Well, there are Bill Nye the Science Guy, Leanne Lord, and Andrea Jones-Roy. All comedians, all hilarious. We've worked with all of them before. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that game show is going to be hosted by George Robb, and also the main conference the next day on August 1st will be hosted by George Robb. And then we're going to have roughly 10 hours of content. You know, definitely 10, probably even more, you know, because we'll run over and we're already kind of stuffing stuff into the schedule here and there. But on August 1st, if you care to join us for the conference, we have a lot of amazing speakers, some of which you know. But please go to necss.org for all the details, and we'd love to have you join us. Now, listen, it's a Friday night and it's a Saturday night during a pandemic. Why go out and risk it? Right, Kara?
Right. What? Stay in and learn some science.
Yes, and enjoy and laugh. And I'm telling you, the game show is going to blow your mind. That's all I'm saying. It's going to be funny in a way that you don't expect. And on top of that, Steve said that at the end of Nexus 2020, he's going to get flat out naked on camera.
No, he didn't.
No, he never said that. He didn't.
I thought you were going to say flat out drunk. And no. I was like, what?
No, he's not doing
that either.
He's not doing anything. But those two do go together. Hope to see you there. And please do consider coming because your support will help us keep going with our conference.
Thank you, Jay. All right, one quick email. This one comes from J.I. Falk from Norway. It says, greetings from Norway. So I was just made aware of a book by Dr. Judy Wood called Where Did the Towers Go? I Googled it and found this documentary. We'll have the link in the show notes. I've never heard of that theory before, and disregarding all the anecdotal evidence of people being flung a block away by some strange force, it was pretty entertaining. What's your take on this? So I sent the link out to you guys, but I don't know if you had time because it's kind of a long, it's like a two-hour video. And there's a long wind up. They don't come right out and say, this is what we're saying. You know what I mean? And you're thinking for a long time, where are they going with all of this? Mm-hmm. You know? So, okay, we're back to the 9/11. How did the Twin Towers fall? Right? That's the debate. And Dr. Judy Wood, right? So they spend a lot of time going over all of her credentials. But honestly, when you listen to her speak, I can't help thinking, wow, this woman is a total crank. Mm-hmm. You know, just seriously. Like, she just sounds like she has parts on order. But what is she saying? She's basically trying to make the case that the towers didn't fall. They were dustificated, that they underwent dustification.
What the hell is dustification?
Jay.
They turned into dust.
Jay, in Dungeons and Dragons, you get hit by the disintegrate spell, and that's what happens
yes,
to you.
They were clearly hit by a beholder with a disintegrator ray.
Or, as Douglas Adams was fond of saying, total existence failure.
Total existence failure.
Decoherence.
Yeah, so she the video spends a lot, and she wrote a book about it, and I read interviews with her and everything. I tried to, it took me a while to figure out what's her actual core claim here. So she's trying to say, for various reasons, mainly from the video evidence, it's like, where are the towers? Where did they go? Well, they turned into dust. Those massive dust clouds that you see as the towers collapsed is the towers being turned basically directly into dust. So how did that happen, you might ask? How do you think?
I want to know.
Or did that even happen?
No, it's all nonsense. So she spends a lot of time trying to make the case for the dustification of the towers, all leading up to the core claim, which is that the towers were actually destroyed by a directed energy weapon.
Oh, of unknown origin, unknown.
That's her claim.
Right, not popularly known.
So, but
technology.
Wait, does she think that, like, the Saudi, like, the people who are flying the plane?
Now, that's all politics. Yeah, yeah. So you ask, well, who did it? And where did they get this energy weapon? And why did they do it? And then she waves all of those questions off as, listen, I'm just an engineer. Those are political questions, you know?
Oh, gosh.
What? Wow.
Yeah.
Here's this implausible theory. Here, wait, what are you? I have some questions on that. No. Just accept my implausible theory.
If you watch the video, it's painful to watch. But if you watch it, there's a lot of anomaly hunting, right? There's a lot of, why did this happen? This doesn't make any sense. You know, not really any positive evidence for anything specific. Just, I can't make sense of this. You know, look at this. How come there was no furniture in the ruins? Well, the furniture was obviously disintegrated. Okay. But what she takes all of this and then goes to Crazy Town, like, and therefore the towers were disintegrated by a directed energy weapon, even though we can't see the directed energy weapon, and I don't know, they don't exist.
Well, this is the god of the gaps logical fallacy, right?
But there's no
absolutely
there's no discussion of what would a directed energy weapon have to be like. How much power would it consume?
It would have to be like an airplane hitting the building.
No, Bob, no. That's funny, but not true. Because the airplane
that's
hitting.
Good. I was going for funny.
Yeah, the airplane hitting. But in all seriousness, it would take a lot more energy to turn the towers directly into dust than it would to weaken one level of beams and start a fire that, you know, further weakened them and then caused
that
it
then
to collapse by gravity. So, you know, according to, you know, experts, you know, the rest of the experts, the NIST specifically, you know, gravity did all the hard work here, right? These towers were freaking big, and the forces involved here were just absolutely immense. Mm-hmm. And anything caught in those forces were pulverized. The towers were pulverized on their way down because of the immense gravitational forces at work. And so you watch them collapse. It's a unique event, no doubt. You know,
right.
You've never seen
nothing
anything else
to.
Like it. There's nothing to compare it to. Nothing that big has ever undergone that situation before. And so the idea that you're going to have some kind of intuition about what's supposed to happen is ridiculous. And of course, it's going to be unusual. You know, it turns out when things are that big and they collapse, they do get pulverized into dust. You know, that is a completely reasonable explanation for what we're seeing and for the lack of a big giant pile of rubble. you know, there was also a footprint. You know, they basically fell into the ground. You know, there was a place in the ground for a lot of the debris
cavity,
to go.
Yeah,
so there was a big cavity in the ground there. You could see it because they left it. They once it's now a monument, but the you know just tremendous energy. Nothing like a desk is going to survive that
right.
kind of absolutely, completely mind-boggling amount of energy.
We're so used, Steve, to seeing like controlled collapse,
yeah.
like controlled explosions when buildings are taken down.
Yeah.
And that's like maybe a four-story apartment complex or a house, right?
Yeah.
That's what like when we see videos of that, not like a 100 some odd story
so
skyscraper.
This is, here's an analogy. This is like a bug trying to understand the physics of a human. And bugs can jump off a table and they're fine. And then they're generating bug conspiracy theories about why a human would be harmed by falling down, you know. When you get massive size differences, the physics are different, you know, in
yeah.
terms of the implications. You could walk on water if you're a little tiny water bug, you know what I mean? The things like surface tension become important.
Mm-hmm.
When
I
you
walk
get
on
big
water.
Enough.
I wanted my head to be inside a droplet of water.
You do?
Yeah.
Not for long, just someone.
Not for long, yeah.
yeah.
But when you get to that big and you have the forces that are that immense, then physical stuff, material, cement gets pulped, turns into dust. Yeah, that's right. Those kind of things can happen with those kind of magnitudes. But anyway, then she replaces, so she has these, you know, anomalies which are not that interesting, to be honest with you. And then in order to deal with a very tiny problem, which is actually just her understanding of this unusual event, she creates a massive problem of, well, where did this directed energy weapon come from? Who used it? How much power would it have taken? How is it that it was, no one saw it, that it was disguised, you know? It just
yeah.
creates orders of magnitude more problems with her replacement hypothesis.
She might as well say aliens did it.
Yeah, whatever. It was clearly brought down by the mental energy of psychic Big Feet all in a circle.
Sure.
Which you couldn't see because they were invisible.
Right.
No, that's why. But she's talking, you know, desperate to be taken seriously. And, you know, it's kind of sad. She does come across to me, this is my opinion when watching it. She comes across as a sad crank who's just angry that no one's taking her seriously. Yeah, because what you're saying is stupid. It's like doesn't even pass the smell test. It doesn't deserve serious consideration. And to anyone who understands how conspiracy theories work, you could just rattle off the logical fallacies that she's making. You know what I mean? It's just an epic failure on many, many levels. And what all her credentials tell us is that, yeah, even somebody who has all the degrees can still have a complete failure of critical thinking. And that's what we're seeing in this case. But it's a good object lesson for skeptics. If you want to just spend a couple hours playing name that logical fallacy, this is a target-rich environment. All right, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious. Or fictitious, depending on your preference. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Sure.
Yep.
Yes,
there is
sir.
A theme. There's another theme this week. A little theme happy recently. The theme is deadly animals.
All right.
Ooh. Deadly animals.
In fact, the most deadly animals.
I have a fear of deadly
humans.
Animals.
Do
you? Okay, here we go. Item number one. Elephants kill 10 times more people every year than lions, sharks, and wolves combined.
Wait a minute. I'm not afraid of elephants. Should I be?
Yes.
Shit.
Item number two.
We are now.
The non-human animal responsible for the most human deaths by direct attack, not through venom, poison, or disease, is the domestic dog. And item number three. Snakes as a group kill more people every year than any other animal, excluding other humans and disease vectors.
Mm, I know, so many caveats.
There's a lot of caveats in there. Because yeah. the topic itself is pretty straightforward, but the items are maybe a little bit more convoluted. All right. Well, Kara, you went first last week, so I'm not going to make you go first again.
Schmanks.
Even though you're making a lot of noise over there.
Schmanks?
Schmanks.
Jay, you go first.
All right. So elephants kill 10 times more people every year than lions, sharks, and wolves combined.
Oh,
all right,
my.
So. All right. Because elephants are land-based animals, I'm not surprised if they're killing more people than sharks. You know, then you'd think that more people would be working with elephants because they're very utilitarian. You'd think that they would be working with them a lot more than lions and wolves, right? Because nobody really is working with wolves or hanging out with wolves.
Sometimes people dance with them.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so, I mean, on a surface, you know, you're around a big animal and they get angry every once in a while and they will run through your house and rip it to smithereens. I do know about that. So, okay, so I'm not really that down on that one. The next one is that this – now, we've got to read this very carefully because Steve said the words are important. Right, Kara?
Yep.
The non-human animal responsible for the most human deaths by direct attack, not through a secondary attack like venom and poison or disease, is the domestic dog. So that means that there's a lot of people getting attacked by dogs and dying. And, you know, not that I am a massive consumer of all things news. I never hear about people dying from getting killed by a dog. And I'm not really feeling this one because you're saying not by venom and poison. Well, yeah, they don't have it. Or disease. If I heard that someone was brought to the hospital because of a snake bite and something bad happened, I would not be surprised. If I heard that someone was killed by a dog, a domestic dog, by direct attack, Steve said, by direct attack.
He's going to shit and get off the
path. I know. I'm sorry. All right. I am going to say that I'm going with my gut here because I believe that in their hearts, dogs are good people. And I'm going to say that that one is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Elephants killing 10 times more people every year than lions, sharks, and wolves combined. Now, fortunately, I have one of these variables, I think, pretty well placed. I think it's the sharks one. I think we've talked about number of shark deaths several years ago, and I imagine that number holds up pretty closely. So, knowing what I know about that and projecting what I think I know about lions and wolves, are elephants 10 times more? So, what it comes down to is how many people are around elephants? And, well, I mean, there's a lot of elephants in India, is there not? A lot of people in India. So that alone could kind of make the number be 10 times more because of that vast, you know, huge population. That's kind of what I'm thinking there. I'm thinking that one's science. The next one, non-human animal responsible for the most human deaths by direct attack. So the domestic dog. Well, this one I think may also come down to numbers. A lot of domestic dogs. You know, where there are people, there are dogs. So it would sort of make sense logically that you would have a large amount of deaths by dog. And direct attacks, sure. You know, there's some pretty powerful animals out there, pretty powerful dogs that can most certainly kill people. So I'm leaning towards that one being science. It leaves the last one, snakes, as a group killing more people every year than any other animal. I think this one's the fiction because, Steve, I think you might be trying to play on one of our natural fears of snakes. Humans don't like snakes. They think they're bad. You know, they get a bad rap. Even in the Bible, they got a bad rap and everywhere else. So there's a sort of inherent conflict between man and snake at the neurological level, I would say. And I think you're trying to play on that with us. So therefore, I think it's a trick. And that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Okay. So elephants, 10 times more people. Yeah, I'm totally buying that. I know sharks don't kill a lot of people. Lions and wolves. I've never even ever heard of a death by a lion or a wolf. Maybe a lion. But it's so rare. I don't think elephants kill a lot of people. But a lot more than those other ones.
They might think about it a lot, though, Bob.
Yeah. So the dog one, direct attack. Jeez, yeah. God. Yeah, that doesn't seem right. I mean, what about a hippo? Hippos kill a lot of people, more than alligators. So let's look at the third one, the snakes. I'll buy that. I mean, live in Australia, you're going to die from a snake. Yeah, I mean, I'm just commenting on this. There's a lot of deadly animals over there. Just like a filter for deadly animals. So yeah, I'll say a dog is fiction.
And Kara.
Okay, so Jay and Bob said the dog and Evan said the snake, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm pretty confident that the animal that kills the most people other than people is the mosquito, but of course that's because of diseases, and none of these call for that. I do think it's quite reasonable that elephants kill 10 times more people than lions, sharks, and wolves combined. It's lions, sharks. I'd say sharks and wolves are actually probably really low on the list. Lions, human-animal conflict is a really big problem in especially like rural parts of Africa. But still, lions, I don't think are as interested in hunting people. It's a lot more risky to like go into a community and pick off a person, even though it does happen. But elephants, like you said, Jay, they just will walk over things and destroy them. And they charge. They're super scary animals. If you're on safari, like you have to keep a really safe distance from elephants, especially like moms who are protecting their babies, because they're very dangerous. And they'll gore you to death, too, with their tusks. The non-human animal responsible for the most human deaths by direct attack. This one, the caveat is getting me, because these all seem like science, Steve. The caveat that's getting me the most is because you said not through venom, poison, yeah, fine, or disease. And I thought most dog bites that were, not most, but many dog bites that were fatal were because of rabies worldwide. So even though I think some people do get mauled to death by dogs, like they'll get bit on the neck or like, you know, it'll puncture an artery and they'll bleed to death or something. I was under the impression that a lot of the deaths from dogs actually were because of rabies, because they can, you know, especially in developing nations, there's a lot of feral dogs and you might see a high rate of infection within the population. So that one is the one thing that makes me think that one's maybe the fiction. And then snakes as a group kill more people than any other animal, excluding other humans and disease vectors. Wait, so here you can include venom or poison, which is what snakes do. They're venomous. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
But I thought, oh, wait, the snail with the tooth, that was just that the venom was really dangerous, not that it killed more people. Right. You remember the tooth snail?
The tooth snail one?
Projection, the projectile?
Snail tooth. Yeah, the projectile tooth at the snail is super toxic. So what you're saying here is that if you were to erase all the rabies cases, the number of maulings by dogs is still higher. I think that's got to be the fiction. Yeah.
Okay. So Evan's by himself and everyone else thinks that the
although I almost went with Evan.
So let's go to number one, because you guys all agree on number one. Elephants kill 10 times more people every year than lions, sharks, and wolves combined. Of course, lions, sharks, and wolves are all predators, and elephants are herbivores.
Doesn't matter.
You all think this one is science, and this one is science. This is science.
Yeah.
Right, that's good so far.
Yeah, this is the easy one. So elephants kill about 500 people per year. Yeah. Lions around 22, sharks 3 or 4, wolves 10.
Okay,
so you add them all up, it's like 30. Yeah. You know, in the 30s.
I knew the shark number was low.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just not a lot of human conflict or human interaction with those animals,
right? And they don't want to mess with humans anyway. No. You know. So, but I do have to say, especially with Jay and Bob. You guys who are very American-centric in your thinking about these animals.
About dogs, you mean?
Yeah, you got to remember this is worldwide. This is around the world.
That's why I brought
up Jay, your dog answer was definitely American-centric.
Yeah.
You know, you're thinking of the relationship that Americans
are you talking about wild dogs?
Have with dogs.
So, well, fair. There's no such thing as a wild. Well, there's an African wild dog.
There are wild dogs, but this said specifically domestic dog.
But domestic kids can be feral.
Sure.
That's the important thing. So and if you've ever, I remember when I was in Morocco, there were like hundreds of feral dogs on the sides of the roads, in the cities, just wandering.
That's why I went
and
with
children are people.
Yeah.
Children.
Christ.
You want to change your answer?
So,
don't forget, Kara, those feral dogs, if you look at the feral dogs and examine just visually, There's no fluffy little puppies that are feral. These are all those dogs that are feral and survive on their wits. They're rough.
They are rough. But that's why I thought maybe they had diseases that they were spreading, and that's why the people would ultimately succumb, not to a mauling, but to a disease.
I guess we're about to find out.
All right, let's go. So the non-human animal responsible for the most human deaths by direct attack, not through venom, poison, or disease, is the domestic dog. Evan, you think this one is science.
Yeah.
The rest of you think this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction.
Yeah.
And Kara, you were exactly right. The most dog deaths are through rabies.
Yeah, they're the biggest vector. I mean, there's like raccoons and stuff like that, but we're so...
There's 99% are dogs. 99% of rabies deaths are dogs. About 35,000 deaths a year attributed to rabies from dogs.
Whoa.
So that's the number four.
Huge.
Number four on the list of animals.
Is that mostly, like you said, Steve, though, because of like feral dogs and places where it's not like people's pets mostly,
it's,
right?
Yeah, because when a dog gets rabies, they get very violent and they bite you and you die of the rabies.
But most people, I guess, being America-centric, it's required that you that your dog gets a rabies vaccine.
It can be prevented by vaccines. It can be, but it's even despite the existence of a vaccine, 35,000 people die from rabies acquired from dogs.
That makes me very sad because I feel bad for the dogs.
Yeah,
me too.
Victims.
It's not their fault.
Yeah,
Jay, I love that dog, that evil dog.
Yeah, I found it. I found like a rabies infested dog picture, like a drawing for Bob, like a Halloween type thing.
I like it.
This really bothers me. I mean, it's a terrible way to die, number one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And and I'm sure that, you know, the dog is sick too. Everybody involved dies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that hydrophobia. Like all the rabies is fascinating. I read a whole book on it and I highly recommend it. It's called Rabid. I was just looking at it on my bookshelf. Rabid. It goes through the history of like rabies vaccine development and like the disease process of rabies. It's horrifying.
So all of this means that snakes as a group kill more people every year than any other animal, excluding other humans and disease vectors, is science. So Kara, again, you're correct that mosquitoes are number one, 750,000 deaths a year, but from spreading disease. Number two killer of people is humans.
People. Yeah, that's so sad.
And that's through homicide. That's just counting homicide. That's 437,000 deaths per year.
Oh, that doesn't even count like war?
It's,
or genocide or anything. It's just like, well, I guess genocide is homicide.
Kara,
but I don't think you, it's.
That's what? Just, according to the figures I'm reading, that's just homicides.
How many people has Killer truly killed? I mean, be honest with
Killer?
Us.
Killer? Yeah. Killer has killed everyone he's met with kisses. Oh.
He slayed my heart.
Can't wait to meet
killed him with cuteness.
Yeah.
So then snakes are number three. So yeah, if you take out humans and disease vectors, snakes are number three.
And that's
venom.
Another
it's through venom.
Brutal way to die.
All right, we're talking about feral dogs here. We're not talking about your friend's dog.
But your friend's dog can still get rabies.
Yeah, it's just dogs who get rabies. It could be your pet.
It could be like
absolutely.
Farm
gets,
dogs. It could be
gets bitten
obviously
by
if you're
a critter with rabies and then it gets rabies and then it bites you and you get rabies.
Yeah, if your dog's not vaccinated and your dog spends a lot of time outside unsupervised, there's a big risk.
So after dogs, they have freshwater snails. Tsetse
flies. Oh, is that
flies.
The toothed snail?
No, freshwater snail because of schistosomiasis. Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah. Okay.
It's all the rest of the assassin bugs.
Assassin bugs, Chagas murder
disease,
hornets.
So these
flies.
Are all like disease vectors.
Yeah, these are all the rest of all disease vectors. Which when you think about it, if you count disease vectors, shouldn't you count other people as disease vectors?
Oh, yeah, that
sure.
would be... Mm-hmm.
Bob, you made a statement about hippos killing more people than alligators. Actually, crocodile deaths per year is about 1,000 per year. Hippos are 500, the same as elephants.
Okay.
500. So
same as elephants.
Okay. I said alligators.
I know, but I don't know if they say quote unquote crocodiles, but I don't know if they're.
I think alligators is a smaller.
They have the narrow snout and they're more aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't have a separate alligator category.
No, but I think that there's also fewer of them, right? Crocodiles are also a massive animal in Africa where there is human-animal conflict.
Right.
And so crocodiles are the animal that kill the most humans by directly mauling them. That's crocodiles.
What a way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Ugh.
Yeah, they bite you, they drag you under the water, then they do the death spiral where they spin around.
Yeah, death roll.
Yeah.
Like, is it death roll?
Whatever.
Death roll, death tumble.
The death dance.
Not a lot of people, only 22 people or whatever die from lions. Wolves. I thought there would be more wolves, but I think we're programmed by... all of the grim fairy tales, you know.
Yeah, and also I think like old westerns and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Or you're like all like middle ages in Europe. Yeah, I think a lot of people were getting killed by wolves.
Like we don't interact with wolves much, even here.
Well,
in
we killed them all. We
so
killed them all.
Out.
They don't. They're
true. Yeah,
we reduced predator numbers significantly because they were eating our livestock.
But like in LA, we have coyotes and they're pretty unafraid of people.
Everybody
so I just saw
has
one the
coyotes.
Other day on my hike.
We have foxes,
but I mean they do. Sometimes people die. They get bitten and die. But it's so rare still because they don't want to hunt.
They go after
people.
Smaller game. Coyotes go after cats, rabbits. You know, maybe
chickens.
a small dog.
Do they eat deer? Or is, I'm thinking mountain lions.
Yeah, that's deer a little bit big for them. And they're also pack. They could be pack hunters. They eat coyotes. But yeah, they wouldn't really go after somebody as big as a human unless they were desperate.
Mm-hmm. Or rabid.
Behind the rabbit.
Yeah.
Right. The coyotes are everywhere. I remember we read that statistic that there was one estimate, this is years ago, that there were 70,000 coyotes in Chicago, like in the middle of the city.
Yeah, coyotes love urban environments. Yeah. And did you know, little factoid or statistic, Los Angeles is one of only two urban centers in the entire world that has a big cat in the city.
Yeah.
Roaming free.
That's cool, right?
What kind of big cat?
Puma or mountain lion or cougar, whatever you want to call it.
We have bobcats.
Yeah, bobcat doesn't count as a big cat.
No.
Yeah, we got bobcats too. I know. They're beautiful.
The only other one is
that's as big as they get here.
Mumbai.
Oh, Mumbai.
Yeah.
Panthers.
Mumbai has
or the leopards.
Is it a leopard? I think so. Yeah, it's a leopard. That's like in the inner like in the city. So when you see those really great camera trap photos of an animal with like city lights behind it like that, a big cat.
Yeah.
It's probably from one of those two cities.
Good to know.
That
and that's one to grow on.
Mm-hmm. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The number of women entering astronomy graduate programs has more than tripled since I started graduate school in the early 1970s. The number of women at scientific conferences has increased, as has the number of women in technical positions on observatory staffs. This is a big improvement. And the future looks bright for women in astronomy. Half of the undergraduate students majoring in astronomy are women now, and the fraction of new PhDs who are women continues to rise. And this was part of an interview, and they were interviewing Katie Pilichowski, who is the Kirkwood Chair in Astronomy at Indiana University Bloomington. She's the former president of the American Astronomical Society. She's a fellow of AAAS, an organization we've been attending the last couple of years. At their conference. She's also a strong advocate of decreasing light pollution and an equally strong advocate of helping more women and minorities find paths to careers in science.
Amazing. And of course, that's like, it's such an inspirational quote, and it's so exciting to see that those numbers do continue to go up. But probably it's also important to point out that we're nowhere near there yet.
Oh, yeah.
And even though we see some parity at like the undergrad level in a lot of STEM fields, and things are especially bad in physics and computer science and engineering. Those tend to be the places where the parity is the lowest. At the undergrad level, it's getting great. But as you climb the ranks, man, that leaky pipeline, like by the time you get to faculty positions, PhD positions first, then faculty and tenured faculty, it's abysmal. So we still got a long way to go.
Still climbing the mountain.
Yeah, it's just taking time to work its way through the system. But yeah, and of course there isn't, you haven't worked out, you know, all the systemic sexism in the system.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that like passively it's going to happen. Like there's some intractable stuff going on at the highest levels, you know, in the highest positions of power. And so it's really important that women like her exist and are mentoring and advocating, because the more we see women who are at those high levels, you know, with multiple, like with tenured positions and lots of accolades, the more that I think women can start to, or continue to follow that path, I should say.
Yeah. Medicine is at the good end of the spectrum there. In fact, like there's more than 50% of women now in medical schools. And I think that probably has more to do with the fact that it's looked upon as a nurturing profession. And so it's traditionally the kind of thing that it was acceptable for women to go into. So because there's a lot of specialty specific differences. Like you say, like engineering, still there's a huge disparity. Other end of the spectrum, medicine, it's pretty much gone. At the lower, as you say, hasn't worked its way fully through the system yet, but if you're looking at like in medical school, you know, the newly minted physicians, it's more than parity.
Right. Same with psychology. It's actually on the even more extreme. It's like 75-80% or something. But still, you see that tenured professors, and especially like department heads, board members, chair people, it's like still almost all white men.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
But it's good to at least we're moving in the right direction. So we have to like simultaneously be encouraged, but also recognize that we're not there yet.
Right. It's not over.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Thank you guys for joining me this week.
Thank you, guys.
And as I always remind everybody, we'll see you on Friday during our live stream on Facebook and the YouTubes and the Twitters. We'll see you all there. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.